When we describe something as pithy, we know that it is succinct with something at its core, something of substance, and there's often a suggestion that what we say is pithy is also, in a way, clever. There's a form of the adjective pithy that is a noun, and that is pithiness, referring to something that is brief, concise, and, well, pithy. But there is an endearing pith-related noun that we're about to hear. It is a plural form. It is pithies. Daniel Klein was a bright young student at Harvard with a notebook he labeled pithies. He tells us, "I must have been 19 or 20 then and had just decided to major in philosophy in college. The reason for that decision and for this notebook was that I had hoped to find some guidance from the great philosophers on how best to live my life." So he wrote down some especially pithy quotes from Plato and Aristotle and the gang. He tells us, though, about halfway through that notebook, "My notations switched to ballpoint pen from fountain pen, and my comments on the philosopher's quotes dwindled to just a few words like, 'There's got to be a better way,' and 'Help!'" The final entry was from the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. "Every time I find the meaning of life, they change it." Under it, Klein says he scribbled, "Now you tell me." Pretty funny, clever, yes, pithy, and with a ring of truth. That is the title of Daniel Klein's book, "Every Time I Find the Meaning of Life, They Change It." And that actually sounds like a one-liner, a joke. You can just hear the drum roll, bada-boom, tsh, that would punctuate the thought. And of course, it is almost as important as having a bushwhacking guide who has gone before on the path, Kant and Kierkegaard and all the rest. When you set out to get a handle on hedonism and to wrestle nihilism to the ground, in a way, to have a fellow traveler as you enter the thicket of thoughts and thinking. Friendship certainly played a central role in ancient ethics and political philosophy. In books 8 and 9 of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle divides friendship into three sorts, as we're told by Andrea Borghini: friends for pleasure, friends for benefit, and true friends. To the former belong those sorts of social bonds that are established to enjoy one's spare time. For example, friends for sports, hobbies, friends for dining or for partying. In the second are included all those bonds whose cultivation is primarily motivated by work-related reasons or by civic duty, such as being a friend with your colleagues and neighbors. In the third category, we find true friendship and true friends. Aristotle explains, true friends are mirrors to each other. To query, "What is a friend?" Aristotle's reply was, "A single soul dwelling in two bodies." And maybe that's the kind of friendship that has developed over the years between Daniel Klein and Thomas Cathcart. Dan went to school at Harvard College, where he received a BA in philosophy. After a brief career in television comedy, which included writing for people like Lily Tomlin and Flip Wilson, he began writing books, ranging from thrillers and mysteries to humorous books about philosophy, including the New York Times bestseller, Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes, and he co-authored that book with his dear friend Thomas Cathcart. Thomas graduated from Harvard with a degree in philosophy. He studied theology at the University of Chicago and then embarked on a career from college teaching to hospice management. And he started his writing life at age 67, linking up with Dan to create Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Aristotle and an Aardvark Go to Washington, and Heidegger and a Hippo Walk through the Pearly Gates. He is also the author of The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge? When you hear them, you may think they could do philosophy as the Car Talk guys did. They are due here in northeastern Pennsylvania for the gathering July 13th, 14th, and 15th at Keystone College in La Plume. The title of the gathering this year is The Myth of Truth. And of course, philosophers over the eons have tried to come to terms with truth with a capital T. We had a chance to speak by phone with Dan and Tom about their lives of philosophical pondering and their writing, and about what they'll be bringing to us when they come to the gathering. Tom Cathcart.
We met on the first day of our freshman year in college. He was standing in my room, actually. He wasn't my roommate, but he was standing there talking to my roommates. They took an instant liking to each other. We've been best friends ever since. This was in 1957.
Over 60 years? You must be very old.
Yes, we are, actually. We are very old. Correct me, Danny, if I'm wrong, but I think I majored in philosophy first, and then Danny was majoring in something else and decided that philosophy sounded good to him, too. So we both majored in philosophy. Both of our parents said, how are you going to make a living with philosophy?
And then we didn't.
For many decades. We stayed friends over all these years. Danny's often lived in Greece or in the Caribbean. We never lived very near each other, but we kept up this friendship. Back in the old days, when you wrote letters, we kept it up by writing letters. Now it's email. And now we only live about 40 miles apart, so we see each other rather frequently now. But we can tell you the origin story of how the first book came about.
It starts with a joke, and the joke is that a guy is in bed with his best friend's wife, and they hear a car pull up in the driveway, and they recognize it's the husband's. So the guy, his name is Sam, he jumps out of bed, and stark naked, he hides in the closet. Just then, the husband comes sauntering in, goes to the closet to hang up his coat, and there he sees Sam standing there, stark naked. He says, Sam, what are you doing here? And Sam shrugs and says, everybody's got to be somewhere.
Silly joke.
I know every Jewish joke ever, so this one just came out of my mouth. On I think it was a phone conversation with Tom.
Yes, it was. And so
and
I
Tom said,
Danny, there's a philosophical subtext to that joke. And he said, what is it? And I said, Sam, the guy in the closet, is giving a very abstract, very objective answer to the husband's question. But the husband isn't asking that question. He's asking an existentialist question. Why are you, of all people, in my closet without your clothes on? So this sort of illustrated the transition from Hegel and the Hegelians to Kierkegaard and the existentialists that followed after. So Danny says, yeah, there's a book in this. Danny had been writing books at that point for, what, 20 years, Danny, 30 years?
Yeah.
So I said, geez, I don't think so, Dan. There are probably 4 jokes in the world that do that.
So we went away for a weekend, and we brought a lot of philosophy books and a lot of joke books. Not that I needed the joke books, of course. And we found loads and loads of jokes of all kinds from all over the world that illustrated philosophical concepts, you know, in all the major categories, in logic, in metaphysics, in ethics and aesthetics, and in epistemology, you know. And we were amazed. And so we wrote a book where we, you know, gave kind of a Phil 101 course, but using jokes to illustrate them. And then nobody wanted it. No publisher wanted it. They all said, oh, that's very clever, but nobody's interested in philosophy. And then the 41st, that's 4-1, publisher said, oh, okay, we'll try it. And they gave us an advance that covered our lunch money. And then 3 weeks later, it was near the top of the New York Times bestseller list.
What did you think? How did you explain that to yourselves?
You know what I felt? Lucky. And this is an irreligious thought, that I, of all people, have been singled out to be lucky, but it's true.
I guess I'm just a lucky so-and-so.
This case actually involves NPR. Somebody, a publicist, I guess, had sent a copy of the book to Leanne Hansen, who used to be the Weekend Edition Sunday person on NPR. And it tickled her funny bone, so she asked us to be on. So we taped it on a Friday, played on a Sunday morning. So about an hour before we went on the air, I went on Amazon to see where we were in their rankings. I'll never forget, we were 2,324. And then about an hour after the interview, I thought, well, I'll look again and see if it moved at all. We were number three.
It was
Who
amazing.
Knew that NPR listeners like to read books?
So then you went on from strength to strength. There was more to come.
Yes, we wrote more. We wrote a book called Aristotle and an Aardvark, and it was about logical fallacies. And then we wrote one that was more popular called Heidegger and a Hippo Walk Through Those Pearly Gates about death, a subject that we're very fond of.
And did you hear from listeners at book signings?
Yes, we hear from them. But one thing we hear from them is they have jokes. I mean, remember one time we were on the road, and I had only heard a few Scandinavian jokes on the Garrison Keillor show. But this guy, who I think came to have his book signed, was a Midwesterner with Scandinavian roots. And he told us one after another Norwegian joke that had us on the floor. And so then we started to include Scandinavian jokes in our future books. So we've gotten a lot of feedback in the way of jokes. Also, I should say that I believe that just about everybody is interested in philosophy. They just get put off by it, by the academies, you know, where you have to do a critical reading of the Critique of Pure Reason, and it's too hard. But just about everybody thinks about what's the meaning of life, and when I'm dead, is that it? And how do I know right from wrong? And is that all there is? And, you know, the basic questions. I think everybody's interested in those.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friends, then let's keep dancing.
And when we read about the ancient Greeks, you know, in Athens, you know, during the heyday of Socrates and others, Epicurus before, we realized that everybody talked philosophy in those days. You didn't have to be a scholar to talk philosophy. You just had to be conscious.
Well, it sounds to me like you all would be perfect fitting into this conference, The Gathering, because the theme is the myth of truth. And we can't have missed the conversations all around us these days about truth. And what is fake and what is real. Do people turn to you and say, well, talk to us about truth, capital T and little t, truth, and what's real? And it's certainly a time to ask questions about reality and what is real and those sorts of things.
Yes,
exactly right, I think.
When we talked about it, Tom and I realized that in some way philosophers are in part responsible for this idea that truth is relative, you know, that the idea of objective, scientific, empirical truth and logical truth is only one way to look at things. You know, we've got this whole movement now of phenomenology, which is about subjective truth, you know, how you experience things tells you the truth, not some objective scientist tells you the truth. Well, there is some credence to that.
Where do the jokes come in?
Ludwig Wittgenstein actually said an entire book of philosophy could be written using nothing but jokes.
Yes.
He didn't say what he meant, and nobody ever knew what he meant.
We did it.
You did it.
That's why we are heirs to the Wittgenstein thing.
All right, where does the platypus come in?
The platypus came in. Do you want to tell the story of how that came about, Tom?
We're searching around for a title, and the editor, publisher, asked Abrams, who bought the book, Abrams, who publishes coffee table art books, don't ask, but they decided they were going to branch out. They published Plato and a Platypus Walking to a Bar. But anyway, the editor was searching around with us around the table for a proper title. And he said, it has to have Plato in the title. It has to have Plato. And we said, yeah, and it has to have Walks into a Bar, because that tips off the fact that it's jokes. He said, yeah, Plato and Plato and Plato and people were throwing out
answers. And
then
he said Proust. Remember?
Proust, yeah. Yeah.
And we said, Proust
wasn't a philosopher.
He wasn't a philosopher or a comedian. You got anything better? And Tom said, platypus.
Just for
the alliteration. We have no idea why Tom said that. I think it's something that happened in his childhood that we don't want to go into. He was abused by a platypus at a young age. Then afterwards, Tom and I went out for a coffee, and he said, oh, my God, what did I say platypus for? This is it. This is the death of it. And then pretty soon it became, you know, then everybody sang Platypus, so we were happy.
Now, is there something rhetorically about the form of jokes that leads us to paradox or the conclusions that might have us break through our obvious, cliched way of thinking?
Danny has the answer to that.
I do have the answer to that. I mean, I think they're both constructed. Jokes and philosophical ideas or concepts are constructed in similar ways. They set you up with an idea, and then they take a radical turn to the left or the right or upside down and surprise the heck out of you, like in a paradox. And so they are both constructed in similar ways, jokes and philosophical ideas. They both surprise you, you know, come at you in a surprising way and then realign your thinking. So we kind of discovered that after the fact, you know, when we started to wonder, geez, why are we getting so many jokes that really do illustrate these points? Here, I'll give you an example of a joke. I don't know why they all have to do with infidelity, but that's another question. So a guy comes home early, and he goes up to the bedroom, and there he sees his wife in bed with his best friend, Sam. And Sam suddenly sits up in bed and says, Joe, he says, what are you going to believe, me or your eyes? that proves or illustrates the idea that we depend on empiricism. What we see, what we sense, is our criteria for truth. And the guy is saying, hey, don't believe that one. Believe what I say. It reminds me of certain people in the D.C. vicinity. What are you going to believe, me or your eyes? And I wonder if you do that often enough. You just get worn down and you say, oh, okay, that falsehood is true, too. I'm too tired.
Let me just ask you then, Danny, did you grow up in a household where people were telling jokes all the time? Where did you get all these?
There was a lot of joking around, particularly puns. And I think about my father was a punster. He was a scientist, but, you know, he loved puns. And then I think about a certain aspect of his punning that is relevant to me now. Like me, he became hard of hearing in his old age. But in those days, you know, getting a hearing aid was a big deal. You had to wear something and have wires all over you. And I don't know, he never got a hearing aid. So every once in a while, he'd make a pun, and I wouldn't have the faintest idea what he was talking about because he was punning on a word that none of us had heard. You know, I had said toothpaste, and he's, you know, and he had heard it as mouthwash. I don't know what he heard it. And then he does a pun on mouthwash. And I'm sitting there, what did Dad hear? So I think that's starting to happen to me around my house.
If a pun fell from his mouth and nobody understood it, is it still a pun? That's a philosophical conundrum.
I can say one thing answering an earlier question that you had, and that is when I got to college in 1957, I had never heard the word philosophy. I had no idea what it was. I'd gone to a public high school where, you know, they didn't talk about philosophy. My family wasn't interested in philosophy. They were only interested in the scientific perspective. And I remember when I declared, and it was under Tom's influence, that I majored in philosophy, and when I realized, yeah, these are questions that I really do think about. And then I told my dad that I was majoring in philosophy. He was furious with me. I mean, at this point, Harvard cost $1,800 a year with room and board. And my father said, you know, this tuition and room and board is killing me. And then you're taking a course in philosophy? What good is that going to do you? Didn't realize that 50 years later it was going to do me some good. There was just this awkward 15 years in between when I had to do other things.
Who was on the philosophy faculty in those days?
Oh, some big names. There were some very big names.
Who was too hard for me, a lot of them were too hard for me, was Willard Van Orman Quine, the logician.
Q-U-I-N-E.
Yes.
Yes,
I think he's Dutch descent. And he was preeminent in the world. And this is a period in philosophy when linguistic analysis was considered the key to philosophy. And the logic of language was the thing that you had to study. And Quine had written a book called Word and Object about the philosophy of language. And that was the course book and one of one of his courses. I must say it was very hard for me, but I kind of just hung on by my fingertips. Tom was the better philosophy student.
Another guy who was there, who was there mostly to teach in the divinity school, but they made him a university professor, which was one of five professors who were singled out as the creme de la creme, given another $1,000 probably or something like that. But they were given a lot of honor and attention. There's Paul Tillich. And Paul Tillich was probably the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century, and he also taught in the philosophy department. So Danny and I took a course from him. I think that's the one that really irritated your father.
Yes, yes. Oh, no, here I am studying theology. That baloney. but Tom was pre-divinity. He went on to divinity school, so this is right up his alley.
Now, why should we pay attention to that sort of questing and questioning today?
We wonder what we're here for, don't we?
Why was I born? Why am I living? What do I get?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that stuff. And I realized when Tom introduced me to philosophy at Harvard that I've been wondering about this stuff all along. I just didn't have the vocabulary, the concepts, I didn't realize other people had been thinking about this for thousands of years and had some interesting takes on it. So it was an eye-opener for me, I must say.
I think another answer to your question, Erica, is that it helps you to learn how to think about everything else, and how to reason, how to construct an argument, how to see through an argument, how to see when what somebody's saying is fallacious or false in the present case. But, you know, it's not whether or not you ever pick up Plato again after you leave. You think a little differently. You look at the world a little differently. You look at it a little more critically. You read the newspaper a little more critically. You know how to construct a counter-argument to whatever somebody in a bar says, you know. So, yeah, I think that's another payoff of it.
Yeah. I mean, for example, one mistake that we see all the time in the news, not just politicians, but they seem to favor it, and that is what Aristotle called the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. And that means if event B follows event A, that means event A must have caused event B. Well, that's not necessarily so. I mean, do you hear that like with the marijuana debate? They say marijuana is a gateway drug to addictive drugs because 90% of heroin users started with marijuana. Well, that may be true, but 100% of heroin users started with milk. And also, there are a number of jokes, and Tom is about to tell you a post hoc joke.
There are some great post hoc jokes. This one's about a Gentile man who's about to get married to a Jewish woman. And she comes to him a couple weeks before the wedding, and she says, "Honey, I've got a huge favor to ask you." She says, "It turns out it would be very important to my mother if you were to convert to Judaism. Is that anything you could possibly find in your heart to do?" So he thought about it for a minute, and he said, "Yeah. You know, I'm not particularly religious one way or the other. Sure, yeah, if it means that much to your mother, I'll be glad to convert to Judaism." He says, "Just tell me what to do." She said, "Well, I'm not sure of everything that it entails, but," she said, "I know one thing, and that is you'll have to be circumcised." And he goes, "Circumcised? Wait a minute. At my age, isn't that going to be terribly painful?" And she said, "Well, I don't know, of course." So he calls up a male Jewish friend, and he says, "Look," he says, "I'm about to convert to Judaism." He says, "I have to get circumcised." And he said, "I'm really nervous about it." He said, "I need to know, does it hurt?" And the friend says, "Well, to tell you the truth, I was 8 days old when I had it done, so I can't really tell you whether it hurt or not. But I'll tell you this, I couldn't walk for a year afterwards."
Post hoc ergo propter hoc.
It ain't necessarily so. It ain't necessarily so.
Daniel Klein and Tom F. Cathcart, co-authors of Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. speaking with us in anticipation of their presentation at the gathering at Keystone College in La Plume, titled Finding Truth in Punchlines, and that's Saturday, July 14th at 11 a.m. The gathering is an annual symposium featuring lectures, workshops, performances, and discussions. This year's theme is The Myth of Truth. Other presenters include the U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, who will read from her work and will engage in far-ranging and deep conversation as well. Many other presenters. For more information on the web, thegatheringatkeystone.org, thegatheringatkeystone.org. You're welcome and you're encouraged to attend the entire conference, but you're also able to attend individual offerings. Tom and Danny's presentation is open to the public, and it's Saturday, July 14th at 11 a.m. And for more information about the gathering at Keystone College in La Plume, July 13th, 14th, and 15th, on the web, thegatheringatkeystone.org, thegatheringatkeystone.org.
Jonah, he lived in a whale.